It's traditionally said that one cannot practice Zen without a teacher. But just what a teacher teaches, or what a teacher does, it's not always so obvious. How do we recognize a teacher? How do we recognize someone who can be a teacher to me? I always like the old saying, it's not the early bird that gets the worm, but the bird that recognizes a worm when it sees one. I think that's true when it comes to teachers. We have to be able to recognize one when we see one, but that has to be very individual, very particular to ourselves. And obviously out there, there are all sorts of people with titles, roles in institutions, big followings of written books, lots of people who are designated teachers or gurus of one variety or another. But what kind of connection can I have with one of those people? What is it that I'm actually going to learn? What kind of relationship do I expect to have? Now you might say there are typically two kinds of ways of relating to a teacher that can go awry. The first is to say, I want to become exactly like them. This is called trying to put someone else's head on top of your own. You think that whatever the teacher is what you've got to become. You've got to become just like that. And then no matter what admirable characteristics the teacher has and you may be picking up on the way, the danger is that you lose yourself. You become an imitation of something. May become a pretty good imitation of it. That may take you a long way, but ultimately that's not what it can be about. The other kind of pitfall, the other kind of pitfall is to find a teacher who's so miraculous, so wonderful, that you feel I can never be like that. They're such an extraordinary, enlightened, special human being. I'm just a million miles away from that. I could practice forever and I would never be that. And those kinds of teachers, again, can be remarkably useless in their specialness. If what their specialness does is open up a kind of unbridgeable gap between you and them. Then you get stuck in the kind of position that Joshu's young student was in, where he asked, does a dog have Buddha nature? Does a dog like me ever get this great enlightenment of masters like you? Creates this enormous gulf. So what do teachers do and how do they teach? What is a teacher for? It's See, there's also traditionally a certain kind of answer to that question that says the teacher has nothing to teach, and there's nothing to transmit. Well, what does that mean? What use do you make of hearing a thing like that? See, one way to understand that is to say that everybody comes to practice thinking they're missing something, thinking there's something they have to learn, thinking there's something they're going to get from the teacher. And we can sum up all those kinds of fantasies under the label of curative fantasy or gaining ideas. And one way to describe the teacher's job is just to over and over again illuminate and then undercut the student's gaining idea, curative fantasy. Whatever the student thinks is missing, there's nothing missing. Whatever the student thinks they've gotten, they haven't gained anything. Whatever the student thinks I have, they don't have, there's no such thing. No, I think that's sometimes a stance I can take with people, at least having them try to develop the habit or practice of honesty about their individual curative fantasies. When I see somebody for the first time in Dokusan, I'll often ask them, what are you doing here? And I mean that question at two different levels. First, what are they actually doing moment to moment in term that they're calling practice? You counting your breath? What do you think that's going to do for you? Trying to empty your mind of all thoughts, be completely clear-headed? How come? See, everybody's got some notion of what the practice is, and I want to hear, well, what are you up to? What are you trying to make happen when you sit here? How do you distinguish a good sitting from a bad sitting? No matter how much people will say they're just sitting, almost everybody, if they're honest, will say that they're, you know, some half hours felt really right or good, and some they didn't like them at all. That wasn't how it's supposed to feel. And that's the most basic clue we have to what our curative fantasies are. What kind of discrimination or judgment are we making about good or bad, moment to moment, about what we're feeling, what we're experiencing or thinking? So we have to start just by being very, very honest about what we're up to, what we're trying to make happen, what we think is working, what we think isn't working. And so that's a job of a teacher, to help create that mindset of honesty about just what this is, what we're doing. So that kind of teaching could be kind of very inquisitive or investigative. And it can be very confrontational for some people, challenging what they think they're up to. But there can be a whole other style of teaching. And we see this perhaps more as a Soto model of practice, in which the teacher just sort of goes about his business, sitting, working, performing rituals, taking care of all the little odds and ends of daily life. And in certain schools, the teacher really doesn't do much more than that. Doesn't offer a lot of instruction, may not give a lot of talks or personal interviews. Teacher just models practice. And in a subtle way, that can be conveying the same lesson, that there's nothing to get and nothing to gain. We're just doing this day in and day out. We're just sitting. And everything the student is striving for just bumps up against over and over again this simple recurrent reality of day-to-day life, day-to-day sitting. And there the teacher might be modeling something that you might call goalless effort or goalless attention. Not trying to become something or make something happen. Yet doing everything with great effort and energy and meticulous attention and care. See, one pitfall to fall into is if you think there's nothing to learn, nothing to gain, well, then I'll just stop practicing. What's this all for? I'll just sit on the beach, drink my margarita, read my novel, and watch the tide roll in and out. Well, could do. But typically, the life of a teacher is one of continuous effort, of practice and working with students and living a certain kind of life. And what's being modeled, in some sense, is that kind of goalless effort or meticulous attention that conveys a message that everything matters. When we say, this is it, it means this moment is worth our attention. It means, in a sense, you can't waste time, because any moment, regardless of its content, is all there is. Pay attention to what's happening, how you're handling it, how you're handling yourself, what you're taking care of. See, that kind of practice of just observe the teacher day-to-day life, that's really something that gets built in to residential or monastic training. It's much harder to see that happening in lay practice. But what you can see, I hope, is the teacher trying to integrate practice in everyday life in their own particular way. And that's a task that each of us has to figure out on their own and figure out how that integration is going to work. If you're in a monastic setting, you don't have a lot of choices to make, a lot of decisions to make. Everything is regulated and you show up. The way we're practicing, you have to decide when are you going to show up, how often. You're going to sit every day morning and evening. Going to come to the sessions. All of them or just some of them? There's no right answer to any of that, but there is an answer. You do have to come up with some kind of answer, and you have to pay attention to how you're making your decision. Am I doing what's easy or comfortable, or am I challenging myself? Why am I challenging myself? See, again, we can get torn between trying to find a way of life and a way of practice that feels right and natural to us. But we can also use that as an excuse to become complacent and always keep practice within a certain comfort zone. And that can be okay for a while. But by and large, life won't stay within a comfort zone for us. And if we think our practice is supposed to keep us comfortable, life just is not going to cooperate with that plan, at least not forever. So there's something about practice that should give us experience of saying yes to what's arising, even when it pushes us outside of our comfort zone. And we do that by sitting a little longer or more often than we might think is comfortable for us. We push ourselves, not necessarily with some goal in mind, but just the willingness to be present to a bigger range of experience. See, I think the danger of staying in your comfort zone in practice is that no matter how long you practice, you can be just staying within a certain groove. You know, and then you say that there are people who've been practicing 25 years, but what they've really had 1 year of practice 25 times. They've sort of done the same thing over and over again. Right? That may suit where they are and what they come to practice for. But there really is a difference between that and people who are constantly using practice to take them outside of their own personal comfort zone. Maybe I'm not such a good teacher for those people. I'm so old and lazy, it just looks like I'm in my comfort zone all the time. But we all have to figure out what it is that we think makes a life of practice. It brings practice off the cushion and into how we handle ourselves day to day with one another. And sometimes I think it's been my experience that having friends in the Dharma is just as important as having a teacher. Because your Dharma friends can sort of act like older brothers and sisters who've been doing this for a while, and you see how are they living a life of practice? What have they committed themselves to? Often, it's our peers who give us a better idea of what's possible. Like I say, sometimes the teacher's example seems too different. I'm never going to be like that, and I don't quite know what to do with the middle ground. Where should I position myself? Just how much makes sense? And I think we often figure that out in relation to our peers as much in relation to our teachers. People we think of as, well, I'm like him. He's not that different a person. If he can do it, I can do it. It's good to have a person like that in your life. That's a big part of what I hope Sangha is for everyone. This big group of examples of what practice can look like. There are lots of ways to do it. Practice can look like all sorts of different things. And you'll see, you look around you and you get to know each other. And you see, how are they doing it? Do I like what I see when I look at them? Do they seem like they're doing it right? Or do you want to end up saying, well, I'm not, whatever happens, I'm not going to do that. I felt that way about some people who I knew who gave up everything to become monastics and didn't always turn out well. And I said, well, okay, maybe the lesson here to learn is that there's not just one way to do this. Maybe I have to be a little more creative than that and figure out how to practice with that degree of effort and commitment, but in my own way. So we learn there are cautionary examples as well as people who are exemplary. So I'll leave it there today. I think we all need to think about what is it we think a teacher is for? How are we relating to a teacher in our own practice? But also, how do we see each other? How do we think about the models of practice that we see all around this Zoom room? Look at all the different ways there are to do this. Which is right for you?